Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the FBI director's remarks before the International Association of Chiefs of Police in Chicago, where James Comey said, "Far more people are being killed in America's cities this year than in many years," attributing the surge of violence in part to the idea that police are being restrained by the so-called Ferguson effect. A former police officer, Philip Sinton, a professor in the criminal justice program at Bowling Green State University who researches police crime and police integrity, joins us to discuss the small rise in the number of police officers charged in fatal shootings compared to the up to 1,000 Americans who will be killed by U.S. police this year. Then we'll examine the lack of a serious debate about America's economy as income inequality rises and populist anger on the right and the left emerges in this election season. The author of Land of Promise, An Economic History of the United States, Michael Lind, the co-founder of the New America Foundation and policy director of New America's Economic Growth Program, joins us. As Wall Street thrives and Main Street languishes, we will discuss the Republican obsession with tax cuts for the rich and how the Democrats are blinded by the orthodoxy of balanced budgets, while globally there is an overabundance of capital looking for somewhere to invest as consumers run out of purchasing power because jobs pay less and wages have not risen since the 1970s. Then finally, we'll try to make sense of the elections in Guatemala, where a comedian with ties to the country's murderous army that is tied to the drug trade and accused of genocide against the Guatemalan people was just elected. Victoria Sanford, a cultural anthropologist who has spent years uncovering evidence of genocide in Guatemala, joins us to discuss why the unqualified Jimmy Morales is no joke, despite the fact that here in the United States, unqualified outsiders like Donald Trump and Ben Carson are leading in the Republican polls. And before we begin, I'd like to invite you to the UCLA Hammer Forum that I'm moderating a week from Tuesday, November the 3rd at 7:30 p.m. We'll have Barney Frank talking about the elections, which are 1 year out. He has, of course, served 3 decades in the U.S. Congress, co-sponsored the Dodd-Frank Financial Reform Act, and is the first openly gay U.S. congressman. And he's as knowledgeable about the politics and issues facing candidates in 2016 as he is outspoken. I'm looking forward to it and hope you can join us again Tuesday week, November the 3rd, 7:30 p.m., Barney Frank. The elections 1 year out, free and open to the public at the UCLA Hammer Forum in Westwood. And joining us now is Philip Stinson, who is a professor in the criminal justice program at Bowling Green State University. Dr. Stinson's research interests include police crime, police integrity, quantitative content analyses, program evaluation, historical analyses and case studies of crime and trials, and unmet mental health and special education needs in the juvenile delinquency system. He's the author of Police Crime, The Criminal Behavior of Sworn Law Enforcement Officers, published in Sociology Compass. Welcome to Background Briefing, Philip Stinson.
Well, thanks for inviting me.
And the head of the FBI spoke before the Police Chiefs Association in Chicago, and later in the week, President Obama will be addressing the same forum. But Mr. Comey seemed to basically suggest that there's such a thing as a Ferguson effect that is deterring police from actually doing their jobs and is therefore, to some extent, responsible for a spike in crime. Would you go along with that?
No, I don't think I would. First of all, there's no data that would support that. There are no statistics that I'm aware of that would support that a Ferguson effect has led to an increase in crime. But it is important to note that this whole idea of selective disengagement by police officers, what's been referred to in some of the literature as depolicing, is not anything new. It's something we've seen across the country at various times, usually in response to some sort of an incident, whether it's a a racially related shooting, something like that. So we've seen it over the years. We've seen it in Richmond in 2007, the New Jersey State Police in 2000 and 2001. More recently, we've seen it in Camden, New Jersey in 2012. We've seen it in Baltimore earlier this year. We saw it in Cincinnati, Ohio about 14 years ago. And if you go back to the early 1970s, this was something that was reportedly happening in Los Angeles and in New York City. So there are times historically when police officers in some areas across the country, engage in a blue flu or a slowdown of their work. And it's typically the type of work that's officer-initiated proactive work. So maybe you're seeing less stop and frisk. Maybe you're seeing less traffic stops, less drunk driving arrests, things like that. But there are a lot of things that cause these spikes in terms of up and down in, police productivity. I don't think it's just one thing. If anything's different this time is the suggestion by Director Comey is that this is nationwide, that we're seeing a selective disengagement by police officers, that there's a work slowdown, that they don't want to be proactive, and we're seeing this across the country. I just don't know that that's true. You know, in my interactions in the Midwest with police officers, I don't seem to see any sort of slowdown in their work. So if anything, it's anecdotal, but I don't agree with his comments.
And before the International Association of Chiefs of Police in Chicago, where Director Comey made these statements, he specifically, though, did say far more people are being killed in America's cities than this year than in many years. So do the statistics bear that out?
Well, preliminarily, it seems to be true in some cities. In Washington, D.C., in Baltimore, Maryland, we've seen murders go up. But again, they've been going down since the early 1990s, and at some point they're going to come back up. It's just, all of this is cyclical. We can argue with criminologists and economists and other scholars all day long as to what the causes are of these wax and wanes in different types of criminal activity, including murders. So I don't know that rise in murders across the country in some large cities this year is a trend. You know, there are a lot of things that cause crime to come up and down. I can remember I worked years ago for a police department in Northern Virginia right outside Washington, D.C., and every Sunday afternoon, if the Redskins lost a football game, domestic violence calls went up that evening. So, you know, there are lots of things that can cause crime to go up and down. But I think it's too early to raise the flag that crime is up and that police officers have stopped doing their job. I think what we're going to see is that we'll see the typical trends up and down with different types of crimes. I don't think you can point it back to a lack of police productivity to say that's why murders are going up. And I think as to the police, slowing down in their work, we're going to see that over the next few months will fall off, and we'll see these patterns, from time to time, these types of things will happen. What worries me more that I did not hear Director Comey talking about is that we have a real problem in this country with police misconduct, and we have a problem in this country with unjustified shootings, often of African-American males, by police officers. You know, we know the best guess is that about 1,000 to 1,100 times a year, on-duty police officers in this country shoot and kill somebody. Out of those 1,000 to 1,100 cases each year, only typically over the last decade, about 5 a year have been found to be unjustified, where criminal charges for murder or manslaughter have been brought against a police officer. This year, so far in 2015, we've seen across the country 12 officers have been charged with murder or manslaughter for shooting and killing somebody on duty in an incident that was found to be, at least initially when charges are brought, unjustified. But it's too early with that, too, to say if we're seeing a trend or if something's going up there, because even though we've only had an average of 5 over the last decade, so from 2005 through 2014, there were 47 officers across the country charged with murder or manslaughter from an on-duty shooting, you have to go back and look at 2007, where there were actually 11. So even though it's an average of 5 a year, we see it go up and down, and that's typical. So it's way too early to say whether, police shootings are on the rise. I think what we're seeing, though, is that, there's a leveling of the playing field here because the police have always been, taken for granted. We don't question their veracity when they give statements as to what happened on the street in any specific incident, especially in these shooting-type incidents. And what we've seen in the last few years, and some of this is the result of video evidence, is that sometimes in these situations, in some of these instances, police officers have been less than truthful in their report writing, in their initial statements that they make. And it's just too early, though, to see if we're seeing a spike in that sort of thing.
So in terms of sunlight being the best disinfectant, and in the terms of the metaphor, I guess sunlight is now the availability of social media, people having iPhones, and the extent to which these police body cameras do provide evidence. Is there any evidence in your research that the police are either unhappy with body cams or sort of resist getting into situations where people seem to have lots of iPhones pointed at them?
Well, you know, it's interesting. We've got four types of cameras out there that we're seeing in these types of cases. We've got dash cam videos. We've got a camera mounted on the front dash of a police cruiser. You've got body cams more recently, where the officer has a body-mounted camera that it's on, recording what's directly in front of the officer. We've got citizen videographers. Everybody's got a video camera in their iPhone or smartphone in their pocket. And then we've got surveillance videos. And the one that seems to annoy the officers the most is when somebody whips out a camera and starts recording video. But at least to answer your question, anecdotally, I've had officers complain to me about the body cams when they've been rolled out in departments where officers are just aghast that they're going to have to wear these cameras. But that's been the case with all sorts of technology over the years that's been rolled out that police officers have had to deal with. You know, I recently had a deputy sheriff come up and talk to me in a restaurant, and he was going on and on and on about how he couldn't stand the idea that he'd have to carry or wear this body cam, that it was invasion of his privacy somehow, and yet the same officer told me that his cruiser has a fleet management type computer tracking system in it, so that at every moment the dispatch center and his employer knows exactly where he is. They can historically go back and look where he was 3 weeks ago on a Monday at 2 p.m. There's all types of technology there, and the officers get over it after a while. And frankly, with this technology that we've seen for many years now, where there are advances in technology and they sell it to the officers, in other words, they convince the officers to go along with it, the way the police departments do that is that they tell the officers, this is for your own safety, because if somebody makes a complaint against you, we'll be able to show that the complaint is unfounded with this evidence. That's how they sell it to officers. So I'm not sure why officers are not seeing the same argument with the citizen smartphone where people are recording the officers, because quite frankly, if the officers are not engaging any misconduct, they're not doing anything wrong, the videos ought to show the officers acting appropriately.
But just to get back, though, to the number of prosecutions of police for fatal shootings, what I find extraordinary is, though, even though the numbers are up, and you say they vary from year to year in any case, compared to the numbers of, and this is according to a Washington Post database, 796, there were 796 fatal police shootings this year. And then another database that the UK Guardian put together recorded 927 deaths from all causes.
Right.
But so let's take the lower number, 796, compared to what, 20 or so? That ratio makes you wonder what's going on with the rest of these shootings. Are we talking about an anomaly here, or are we not investigating the bigger number more?
Well, again, I think it's about 1,000 to 1,100 times a year that an officer shoots and kills somebody while they're on duty. There are lots of other shootings, by the way, where officers shoot and kill somebody off duty, but let's just stick with the on-duty shootings. So the year's not over yet. The Washington Post is at, 796? I think it'll be over 1,000, unfortunately, by the time the year is over. But what happens in most of these cases is that the shooting is found to be justified. And under the relevant case law that the Supreme Court has laid out, if an officer reasonably believes there's an imminent threat of serious bodily injury or deadly force being imposed against an officer or a third person, the officer is justified in using deadly force. So that's why many of these cases are not prosecuted. Most of the cases are not prosecuted is because there's been a finding through an investigation by a law enforcement agency, through an investigation by a prosecutor's office. Somehow there's been a finding that that under that standard, an objective reasonableness standard, the officer was justified in shooting. But in some of these cases, all we have to go on is the officer's statements as to what happened, you know, if there's no video evidence. In some of the cases where officers have been charged, we see several things here. It could be that they shot somebody in the back, and, that raises questions immediately. In some of these cases, another officer comes forward and gives a statement that conflicts with the shooter's testimony, the officer who shot somebody. And that happens in these cases that are prosecuted, where some other officer or a group of officers come forward and they say, that's just not what happened. And they end up writing reports and sometimes testifying against the officers at trial. But in the absence of one of those types of things, you don't have any video, you don't have another officer coming forward and saying, no, he wasn't justified in shooting him, you don't have any video and you don't have anybody shot in the back, historically what's happened is we take the officers at their word. So what we're seeing here, and what I think there is an uptick in, is that in all these cases over the last year where we've seen on the news and in social media these various videos, it's raising questions as to the bigger question, and I think you hit the nail on the head there, that perhaps some of these shootings of the 1,000 or so a year where officers shoot and kill someone in this country while they're on duty, perhaps more than 5 to 12, which is the range that we've seen over the last 11 years, perhaps a lot more of those, or some more, are unjustified. And frankly, even if it's just one more this year that's not justified, that did not result in criminal charges, that's a problem.
Well, Philip Sinton, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Oh, my pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Philip Stinson, who is a professor in the criminal justice program at Bowling Green State University. Dr. Stinson's research interests include police crime, police integrity, quantitative content analyses, program evaluation, historical analysis and case studies of crime and trials, and unmet mental health and special education needs in the juvenile delinquency system. He's the author of Police Crime, The Criminal Behavior of Sworn Law Enforcement Officers, published in Sociology Compass. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the lack of a serious debate about America's economy in this election year. Are you really for peace and equality? Or when my car's hooked up, you know you want to follow me. Your laws are minimal, because you won't even think about looking at the real criminal. This has got to cease, because we be getting hyped to the sound of the police. That's the sound of the police. That's the sound.
Grocers, though we have fun, tax collectors getting closer, still we have fun. There's nothing surer, the rich get richer and the poor get poorer. In the meantime, in between time, ain't we got fun?
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Michael Lind, who's the co-founder of the New America Foundation and policy director of New America's Economic Growth Program. He's co-author of The Radical Center, The Future of American Politics, and Made in Texas, George W. Bush and the Southern Takeover of American Politics, and author of The American Way of Strategy and What Lincoln Believed. And his latest book is Land of Promise, An Economic History of the United States. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Lind.
Glad to be back.
Michael, there's a summit underway over this weekend and on Monday in Houston, where the Bush family have called in the former President George H.W. Bush and his son, President George W. Bush. And of course, Jeb is the center of attention. And Barbara Bush is handing out bumper stickers, and all the bundlers are there. He started out of the gate with about $100 million just flowing into his coffers. And a lot of the wealthy donors, I guess, are having buyer's remorse, or at least they're concerned that he can't get off the ground. Do you have an explanation for this extraordinary dud that has landed so flat on the American political landscape?
Well, let me begin by saying that this conclave reminds me of the play and movie by James Goldsmith, The Lion in Winter, where Eleanor of Aquitaine and I think it was Henry II get together and they have a battle over which of the sons will inherit England. I think the real problem facing not just Jeb Bush, but all of these moderate candidates, and to some degree Hillary Clinton, is that the second shoe has dropped now since the Great Recession. So the first wave of political response in the Great Recession actually was kind of conservative, because the middle classes and the elites wanted to preserve what they had. And as the Russian saying used to go in the Tsarist times, the shortage will be shared equally among the peasants. So the initial response on both sides of the Atlantic to the Great Recession was a conservative politics of austerity. But that was undertaken in the expectation that this would then lead to an upswing in the economy by 2013, 2014, 2015, and the economies are still depressed, partly because of contractionary austerity policy. So what we're seeing now, again, it's on both sides of the Atlantic, I don't think you can look at the U.S. in isolation, is a second wave of reaction to the Great Recession that began in 2008, and it's a populist wave. And it manifests itself both through the populist left, like Bernie Sanders, and through the populist right, which I would include both Donald Trump and Mike Huckabee in.
So is that to say, then, going back to the 2008-2009 crash that happened at the very end of the Bush administration, at the beginning of the Obama administration, is that to say that had Obama handled it differently, the populist revolt might have happened right away, in the sense that basically it looks to me as if Obama and the Democrats got nothing out of it. They did the responsible thing and stepped up to the plate and saved the economy after $13 trillion was wiped out and $9 trillion of home equity. And it doesn't look like they got anything in return from bailing out Wall Street. Wall Street is clearly backing Bush and all the other candidates, certainly not backing Hillary.
Well, a lot of people, particularly progressives, would compare Obama unfavorably with Franklin Roosevelt in 1932 when he ran 1933 in office. But I think you can make the case that 2008 was the equivalent of 1929. It wasn't the equivalent of 1932. By 1932, you already had 4 years of the Great Recession, and it was clear that things weren't getting better, and then that actually created more of a space for reform than had existed if Franklin Roosevelt had been elected in 1928. And the crash had happened on his watch, he wouldn't have gotten the New Deal. And we have to remember, if you go back both from 1929 to 1932, but also from 2008 forward, most of the establishment thinkers on both sides of the Atlantic were insisting that the economy was going to rebound any moment now, right? And 2009 came and it didn't really rebound. In 2008, obviously, there was slow, gradual recovery, but still massive underemployment and very, very, very slow growth, including slow productivity growth. So, you know, sadly, I think it actually takes the experience of half a decade or a decade of extremely abnormal conditions to shake the deference of people to conventional leaders, but I think that deference has now been shaken.
And again, I'm speaking with Michael Lind, who's a co-founder of the New America Foundation and policy director of New America's Economic Growth Program. He's the co-author of The Radical Center, The Future of American Politics, and Made in Texas, George W. Bush and the Southern Takeover of American Politics, and author of The American Way of Strategy, What Lincoln Believed, and his latest book is Land of Promise, An Economic History of the United States. But going back to those crucial negotiations where Obama certainly had a lot of leverage, and essentially all he got out of it was a stimulus package that wasn't sufficient, and the Republicans didn't even support that. My understanding is that in those negotiations, Obama wanted to extract more from the Republicans in the sense that he could get rid of the Bush tax cuts, and they stayed on the books apparently because Vice President Biden urged him not to go that route. So is there anything to that notion? Because, you know, the delayed reaction has been over inequality. That's very much the mantra in this election, at least on the Democratic side, both with Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton. And it seems as if since 2008, after Wall Street hosed Main Street, it's in the intervening years, Wall Street's just gotten richer and Main Street's gotten poorer. And finally, people have had enough.
Well, I think the problem with Obama is he essentially is part of the 1990s neoliberal, Clinton-Blair third wave movement, which was obsessed with balanced budgets. And the last thing you really should have been concerned about in 2008-2009 was raising taxes, including taxes on the rich. You know, the last thing you want to do at the trough of a depression or near depression is to cut spending or raise taxes. They both contract demand. That's classic Keynesianism. So it was kind of a fetish, and you saw the same obsession, which comes from Robert Rubin and that wing of the Democratic Party, with balanced budgets a few years later when he offered to use an inflation adjustment called a CPI, chain CPI, to cut Social Security benefits in return for slightly increasing taxes on the rich in the interest of balancing the budget. So in that case, you know, I'm very critical of Obama, whose macroeconomics, just was out of sync with the time. And it's interesting that Larry Summers, his former advisor, now out of power, advised Justin Trudeau, who is promising a debt-financed orgy of infrastructure spending in Canada. And Summers' own view of these things has become much more radically Keynesian than it was when he was advising Obama.
Well, we know that instead of the shovel-ready jobs or whatever came out of that first stimulus package, if you would have had a real infrastructure project with interest rates at all-time low, they're still at 0.25%. It seems the most propitious time of all to fix America's ailing infrastructure. But
well, the other big mistake that was made was most of the American states have balanced budget rules in their constitutions, which is totally insane, because it means that at the very moment that you should not be reducing public spending means you have to cut back on state and local infrastructure spending and on public employment in the states. And so the contractionary policies from laying off teachers and police and firefighters and so on after 2008 neutralized a lot of the federal stimulus. What should have been done was the revival of a program from the Johnson and the Nixon years, which was general revenue sharing. Because in a recession, the federal government, and certainly this one, can borrow at very low interest rates, unlike the state of Illinois or the state of California, and it could share that money with the states. But that was so beyond the even the liberal and progressive thinkers, you know, who were part of the mainstream establishment in 2008-2009, not to mention the conservative Republicans who came to power in the midterm elections of 2010, it wasn't even considered as an option.
But this quantitative easing and all of the money going to the banks at low interest rates, and then they can charge it back at 6 or 7% to students, etc., which has created a whole new indentured class that we've never had before, where kids are in debt almost for life before they even get a job. There's something so distorted about it.
Quantitative easing, again, just classic Keynesian macro theory, was intended to be part of a 1-2 punch. So quantitative easing would keep interest rates down to enable you to borrow in order to spend on the fiscal policy. And because of not only conservative Republicans, but also a lot of neoliberal New Democrats, this opposition to federal spending, you've only had one half of what should be monetary policy and fiscal policy. So it's kind of like a plane flying on one engine.
Well, but the engine that's dead is savings, surely. I mean, there is no way for people to save. I mean, why don't we have, for example, you know, victory bonds from World War II or something like that? It's just hopeless that it forces people into risky investments, as opposed to, by the way, most pensions have been eviscerated and they're no longer secure. So,
well, but let me push back on that a little bit. To begin with, the vast majority of poor and working class Americans don't save because they can't. Their wages are just too low, and consequently, they rely almost entirely on Social Security in retirement. So, the wealthy are invested in the stock market, which has done had its ups and downs, but it's recovered somewhat. So there really are very few people who depend for their retirements neither on Social Security nor on stocks and bonds, but on savings like cash and CDs and so on. And I think they're going to have an unhappy fate because the structural conditions that have created these low interest rates, which ultimately are linked to too much global savings, looking for too few investment opportunities. And particularly, it's worse in Europe and Asia, where in different ways consumer demand has been suppressed, particularly in China and Germany. So I think that the day of the cash saver probably has gone for good.
So is there any kind of economic discussion going on now? I know most of the stuff that you hear on the Republican side, is some of it's pretty amazing. And on the Democratic side, there's nothing very new or original except for Bernie Sanders. The fact that the S word, socialism, has actually become, I don't know whether it's accepted, but at least it's in the mainstream lexicon now. The kind of
there's a total absence of discussion of a way forward in terms of economic growth. On the right, you have, you know, the old supply side economics: cut taxes for the rich, and they will invest money, and then you will create all of these jobs. The problem is there was some validity of this, possibly in the 1970s, but there's no shortage of investment capital now. As I said, there's too much capital sloshing around the world and too few opportunities. On the left, the entire emphasis is on fixing and expanding the safety net, which is very important, particularly because the United States safety net has lots of holes in it compared to Western Europe with regard to paid family leave and child care and elder care. But the energy in the Democratic Party is focused entirely on technologies to battle the long-term issue of climate change, you know, electric cars and solar panels and sustainable this and that, which is all very well and good, but they actually don't have a theory that they can present to the public of how you're going to boost productivity, growth, and employment.
Well, so there's money sloshing around, interest rates are at an all-time low. Is this simply a failure of imagination? I mean, when you talk about repairing the safety net, the social safety net, which is pretty tattered compared to, say, Denmark that Bernie Sanders mentioned, Paul Ryan has now been elevated to the number three spot in the Constitution, and there's no way in the world that this Ayn Randian is going to entertain anything along those lines. So where's the imagination going to come from? Because it sounds like there is a way to raise all boats, but nobody's doing anything about it.
Well, and it's a global problem, too. You know, and I think this is where you need world historical thinkers like Marx and Keynes and Hobson and others to look at the whole system, because you can make the case that what's happening in the world, in Europe and Asia, as well as in the U.S., kind of confirms theories of underconsumption, which go back to Mill and Hobson and Keynes. That is, in a capitalist system, the rich don't want to spread the wealth enough, and so money accumulates at the top. And then finally, demand gets choked off because the workers simply can't also be consumers. And this has happened in China, where consumption as a share of GDP, until recently, that they realized the problem, they're making reforms, but until recently it was at these horrific eras that you haven't seen since the industrialization of the Soviet Union in the 1930s. Essentially, the industrialization of China has been built on low wages for Chinese workers. In foreign demand, in Europe, the Germans have pursued a policy in which German economic growth outstripped German wage growth and thus German consumption following the Hartz reforms in the early 21st century. And they want the rest of Europe to run perpetual surpluses by suppressing wages the way they did. And in the United States, actually, has been somewhat moderately more sensible than the Europeans, at least the Germans and the Chinese and East Asians. So it's a question as to whether capitalism, and I'm by no means a wild-eyed radical, but you know, this was, you know, people like Keynes raised this question. is it capable of sustaining the demand for its products and services? And that demand at the end of the day has to come from masses of ordinary people, either who get this income either through wages or through welfare benefits and redistribution.
But if you track, I mean, one of the most startling graph of all is if you track productivity and the household income, it's been relatively run in parallel up until the 1970s, and then it started to diverge where productivity goes way up and household income starts to dip down. And it's a very clear example of who's benefiting from increased productivity, which, of course, in the electronic age and with new technologies, increased enormously. How do you rectify that? Because that's classic Marxism, isn't it? Where it's clear that the rich are the beneficiaries of increased productivity and the poor are not even getting trickle down.
Well, and this gets into the robot economy problem, because one of the things that's happened, and it's happening in all of the developed countries and the developing countries as well, is by its very nature, productivity means that labor-saving technology is displacing labor, which so the former labor-using field now becomes capital-intensive. It's largely mechanized or automated. And so the workers it sheds go into fields which cannot yet be mechanized or automated. So economists like William Baumol pointed this out decades ago. That means that eventually, in an advanced technological society, most people will work doing things that machines can't do. It's largely non-traded domestic services, and some of them, you know, may be sophisticated, you know, like legal strategy for international law firms, but a lot of them will be emptying bedpans, you know, taking care of children, of elderly people, of nursing aid jobs, and which are perfectly legitimate as well. But see, this is where the classic liberal left breaks down as well as the right, because you can't, if far more people work in the nursing home sector than in the largely automated factory sector where all of the productivity growth and profits are found, then unionizing the nursing home sector is not the solution, because the nursing home owners are not rich. They're not like the Google or the Apple entrepreneurs. It's a very low margin, low profit business. So even if you completely unionize these low profit, human intensive sectors, there's just not that much money to share between management and capital. There's sometimes, I mean, you can raise the pay of McDonald's workers and so on. So I'm not against that. But there's a big difference between the McDonald's workers sharing in McDonald's profits and UAW workers who were unionized in the 1950s and 1960s. And so people have speculated, since there was kind of an interest in automation in the economy in the 1960s, that you just have to boost redistribution of some kind, you know, from the owners of the largely productive robotic industries to the rest of the population, who will be doing socially useful tasks, but their market wages alone may be insufficient.
Well, just in the last minute or so, Michael Lind, returning to this election, you've given us an extremely cogent view of what is not being discussed in the electoral politics about our economy and how it may be improved for all of us, or most of us even, or as opposed to a few of us. In the other arena, back to the political arena, the strangest thing to my mind is, you know, we saw Hillary Clinton being grilled for 13.8 hours the other day over some trivial, the eighth investigation into Benghazi, and nobody, of course, is looking into what really happened in Libya, which is a more interesting and more compelling issue, but it was so trivial. And the only person out there that's even raising these questions of the disparity between the fact that there was no investigations of the failure of 9/11, Bush was only before the 9/11 Commission for 1 hour compared to Hillary's 13.8 hours being shouted at by these sort of yapping dogs. And there's never been an investigation into the Iraq War. The British have had one, and Tony Blair's trying to get out ahead of it now. What explains that? The only person who's really raising the important questions about what happened to American foreign policy and why we're faced with these disasters in the Middle East is, of all people, Donald Trump.
Well, that's right, particularly with Bush's responsibility, alleged or real, for the 9/11 disaster, not foreseeing and forestalling it. Now, 9/11 is a very simple political case. It's true that it happened on Bush's watch, but a lot of the planning had taken place, including part of it on American soil under Bill Clinton. So it was just understood at the time that rather than having Republicans and Democrats go after each other for the next 30 years over, you know, was Muhammad Atta Bill Clinton's problem that he should have addressed, or, you know, George W. Bush's, essentially the two parties agreed they just wouldn't go there. You know, there would be sort of an act of oblivion and amnesty, and it just was swept under the rug. But it will be interesting to see if Trump leads to reconsideration of that issue. And in terms of the Iraq War, it was somewhat different. There was bipartisan support for it, not so much in Congress, but among the foreign policy elite, Democrats and Republicans, the Democratic foreign policy thinkers and in and outers, government officials, tend to overlap in their hawkish views with those of the Republican Party, and as opposed to the Democratic base. And so I think simply embarrassment on the part of leading Democrats who had initially been cheerleaders for the war that turned out terribly in Iraq, and to a lesser degree Afghanistan, I think that explains the bipartisan agreement not to revisit the subject.
Well, it's pretty glaring when you think that four people died in Benghazi and 4,500 Americans died in Iraq, 23,000 were wounded, 100,000 plus disabled, trillions spent. It's just that the proportionality I find absolutely dismaying. But
even in Libya, to me, the real issue was, I think the war was a mistake. I opposed it at the time. It was supported by Britain and France. The U.S. kind of reluctantly went along, but you know, that should be the debate.
Sure.
Did that war, but we forget about that, but that was a war of choice, and it was launched by Barack Obama, who had been elected to end, well, I don't think Afghanistan was a war of choice, at least the initial phase, but certainly the Iraq War was a war of choice. And so it looks as though he will depart two terms with the U.S. fighting in both Iraq and Afghanistan, and having created a third unnecessary war in Libya.
Well, Michael Lind, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Michael Lind, who is the co-founder of the New America Foundation and policy director of New America's Economic Growth Program. He's the co-author of The Radical Center, The Future of American Politics, and Made in Texas, George W. Bush and the Southern Takeover of American Politics, and the author of The American Way of Strategy and What Lincoln Believed. His latest book is Land of Promise, An Economic History of the United States. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back to try and make some sense out of the elections in Guatemala, where a comedian was just elected president. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is cultural anthropologist Victoria Sanford, who studies human rights, international humanitarian law, and the anthropology of genocide, race, and gender in the Americas, as well as child soldiers within Guatemala, Colombia, and South Africa. She's the director of the Center for Human Rights and Peace Studies, based at Lehman College at City University of New York, and has spent years uncovering evidence of genocide in Guatemala. Welcome to Background Briefing, Victoria Sanford.
Thanks so much. It's my pleasure to be here.
And obviously there are comparisons being made to the election of Jimmy Morales, a 46-year-old comedian in Guatemala over the weekend. Comparisons with him and Donald Trump, since he's an unqualified outsider. And as it happened, he ran against a former First Lady, Sandra Torres. And of course, the connections are being made to former First Lady Hillary Clinton. But the results were pretty extraordinary. Morales got 67.4% of the vote, whereas Torres got just 32.6% of the vote. So this is a resounding victory.
Well, it's not a victory for the people of Guatemala. And I think even if people might make those comparisons to Donald Trump, saying that Donald Trump and Jimmy Morales are both unqualified candidates, the difference is that the army and war criminals didn't choose Donald Trump to be the front runner, whereas war criminals and military people and former military people in Guatemala chose Jimmy Morales. They describe themselves as having a nationalist ideology. The person who founded this party is Kilo Ayuso, and Kilo Ayuso runs the Guatemalan Veterans Organization. And Kilo Ayuso was the commander of a military base in the region of Chimaltenango at the height of the genocide. So he's a genocidaire. And if Rios Montt is being charged with genocide and Otto Perez Molina is in jail for corruption and should be charged with genocide because he was a commander in northern Quiché during the genocide and during massacres, Kilo Ayuso is next in line. So it's not a victory for the people. What it really is a emblematic of the failure of the system. Sandra Torres, I think between the two, would have been the better candidate, but clearly the powers that be in Guatemala, military, former military, and entrenched oligarchy chose to support Morales, who said that he would lower taxes and hand out iPhones. That was his party platform. No more corruption. I'm going to lower taxes, and I'm going to give iPhones to all children.
So this sounds like a massive fraud was perpetrated. What does it say about the Guatemalan people? Did they vote? What kind of numbers came out? Because I know that there was this, after they got rid of this previous president who was finally charged, there was a sense that the elections were proceeding too fast and that there weren't any real leftist candidates available. Was this sort of rushed through and the choices weren't good, or have somehow the majority of Guatemalans been so totally hoodwinked?
I would say all of the above, and I would start with the rushing of the elections. When the Renuncia Ya, the Renounce Now campaign, which began as a spontaneous campaign, basically. I mean, some young people put up on Facebook, let's go meet in the plaza and have a demonstration, and they thought maybe they'd get several dozen people, and they ended up with 10,000 people in the plaza, right? So, I mean, it shows that was the first demonstration, and those demonstrations grew and grew to where they could call on people through Facebook and have 100,000 people in the plaza. Now, that's different than having an organized political party. And all of these political parties and the machinations that they go through to move through elections and where they get their campaign financing from, they run multi-million dollar campaigns. And that money isn't coming from marginalized, poor indigenous peasants. It's coming from international business and national business and national interests and drug trafficking. And that was how Baldizón, who had been the front runner initially, when Perez Molina went down, Baldizón went down also in terms of the election, because everyone had been saying for years he's backed by drug traffickers, like his money is drug trafficking. I don't know that that's true, but that's certainly what the rumor was. And one of his key people was being investigated for drug trafficking. The other issue is, I don't think it's even a question of having leftist parties. I think it's a question of having a party that doesn't have an alignment with a previous corrupt regime doesn't have an alignment with the army, the military, and isn't owned by the oligarchy or big business in Guatemala. And that pretty much eliminates all of the parties. And so I think to understand it also is that people didn't want that election to happen. The people who pushed Pérez Molina out and got him to resign with all of the demonstrations, they wanted elections delayed. And the oligarchy and their representatives in government, of course, insisted on the constitutionality of continuing with the elections. And a lot of people didn't vote. And I don't know what the actual final numbers were of how many people voted as opposed to how many people had the right to vote. I was actually looking for that earlier today. But I think a lot of people just felt really marginalized from the political process. And I think that's only understandable knowing what the political history of Guatemala is, a country that suffered genocide, where genocidaires continue to run the country, where, you know, the big issue for the equivalent of the Chamber of Commerce, CACIF, is not letting the minimum wage go up to be like $8 a day. Right? I mean, they don't care that people are starving, and people feeling really disenfranchised, and the neoliberal model that's come in right at the time when people could finally elect local officials, there's no public coffer for those local officials to work with. And so the political process on that side is pretty not just corrupt, but bankrupted, really. And at the same time, the Renuncia Ya showed that there's a possibility for participatory democracy. But I think that even if we look at the success of that movement in pushing out Pérez Molina, it also showed that the real power rests with the military, and it rests with these big business people who controlled the country forever, and that's how they end up getting a comic elected, right? I mean, the ideology of this organization, the Frente de Convergencia Nacional, the National Convergence Front, they define themselves as being nationalists with their fists in the air, and they talk about how the good Guatemalans should run the country, right? And that's military language. Los buenos, the good ones, are the ones who follow the authoritarian line, right? And so I think in that sense, the social movement also needs to take this opportunity now over the next 4 years to develop into a real organization and a movement that can participate politically and act politically and support political parties or have a political party. Otherwise, they'll continue to be marginalized as well, even if they can get 100,000 people in the plaza with through, you know, going on Facebook and organizing. That's a huge success. But pushing out one corrupt president doesn't transform a corrupt country, because there's always someone else to fill in that spot.
And again, I'm speaking with cultural anthropologist Victoria Sanford, who studies human rights, international humanitarian law, the anthropology of genocide, race and gender in the Americas, and child soldiers in Guatemala, Colombia, and South Africa. She's the director of the Center for Human Rights and Peace Studies based at Lehman College City University, New York, and has spent years uncovering evidence of genocide in Guatemala. So these front men for the army and the head of the Veterans Association, and the army, of course, has been tied to drug trafficking. And when you talk about the oligarchs, it's a hideous trinity, isn't it? Of genocide, a genocidal army, drug barons and drug traffickers who put everybody on the payroll, and a kind of enduring oligarchy. And they've been involved in a 36-year civil war in which hundreds of thousands of their citizens, mostly indigenous people, have been murdered. And now they've managed to come up with a charming, I guess, funny front man who ran on the ticket of cleaning up corruption, when, of course, the endemic corruption is, you could attribute to the oligarchy, the drug traffickers, and there's nothing more corrupt than drug trafficking, after all, and
right,
this murderous
right.
military. So the whole thing seems breathtakingly cynical to me.
It is. I think it is breathtakingly cynical, and it's a situation where you think about what it means for people who actually live in that country, when the majority of children in that country are hungry. Like while we're speaking right now, the majority of children in Guatemala are hungry, and that's outrageous, right? And so, I mean, Morales has said since he was elected, after he spoke of his anti-corruption campaign and went back to he was at this hotel that it's the Andriatica Hotel. This was in the newspapers in Guatemala, concluding his discussion about how he was going to fight corruption. He then left and went and stayed in $190 a night hotel. Now, who has that much money in Guatemala? He's not a rich man, so I don't know who's putting the bill for that hotel. But he said that his first priorities would be medicine for hospitals, combating malnutrition, education, development for business development, and no tolerance for corruption. So, you know, medicine for hospital means he's going to go to the international community and ask for that. Combating malnutrition, he's going to go to the international community and ask for that. Developing business means he's not going to support local community efforts. It means he's going to support business and the hardline growth, you know, the growth of the gross domestic product in Guatemala as opposed to distribution, how wealth is distributed in Guatemala. And if you don't raise taxes, then you can't redistribute any wealth, right? I mean, Guatemala has the highest inequality in wealth distribution in the Americas, except for Haiti. It's crazy.
So what's the international reaction then? The U.S. must be aware of the fact that Guatemala's a narco-democracy, and they've certainly been aware of how long the army has been conducting genocide. So is there any way to call this hoax from the international community if unfortunately the Guatemalan voters, and we don't know what percentage, abstain from voting? Nevertheless, this is a pretty sad event if they got totally taken in by the oligarch's frontman, this comedian.
Well, I think it is. And I think that the world is in a difficult position to try to do anything about that. And unless he does something corrupt that he's caught on doing, unless he violates some national or international norm, he's been elected president. I mean, we've had presidents like that too. And sometimes they come close to being prosecuted. Usually they don't. But I think that what the international community should focus on is making sure that he keeps Thelma Aldana as the attorney general, because she has been a key person in working with CICIG, the United Nations Commission Against Impunity, which played a key role in pushing Perez Molina out because of their investigation. I mean, their investigation showed that over, I think it's a 14-month period, that Perez Molina and his vice president, Roxana Balbetti, they charged $3.5 million in import taxes. And they each took $880,000. The rest was what they distributed amongst their friends as payoffs, right? So, one would hope that we're able to keep Thelma Aldana as the attorney general. And then the other thing is that party, the Frente Convergencia Nacional, does not have control of Congress. And so maybe what that means for the international community is, just as a lot of effort has gone into supporting development of the judicial system, maybe what the international community should do is start focusing on helping make that Congress function. Because if he doesn't have control of the Congress, then maybe there's actually a possibility to make the different branches of government function.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Victoria Sanford.
Thanks so much, Ian. Thanks for caring about Guatemala.
And again, I've been speaking with cultural anthropologist Victoria Sanford, who studies human rights, international humanitarian law, the anthropology of genocide, race and gender in the Americas, and child soldiers within Guatemala, Colombia, and South Africa. She's the director of the Center for Human Rights and Peace Studies, based at Lehman College, City University, New York, and has spent years uncovering evidence of genocide in Guatemala. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.